complaining, what's the best day? Watching that movie, I'm the little lonely.
Alright, lights, camera, action. Now where's the mullet, where is he? Is he coming in by chopper?
And now, live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, it's time again for your dose of action cinema history from the 80s, 90s, and beyond with the Lethal Mullet Podcast. Oh, g'day, mate, how you going?
I'm the Lethal Mullet, and I'm over. I come to you from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia for episode number 180 of the podcast, and we're going to be looking at Cobra Kai. We've looked at some of the seasons before, but we're going to really delve into what this franchise is and what it is in relation to, obviously, the Karate Kid films. Joining me all the way from the United States is my pal and fellow martial arts student, instructor, and let's just say passionate about martial arts big time, is, of course, Lee Fillingsness. Buddy, how are you?
No, I'm doing really good. I know that, you know, we've got some buddies that covered this series a while back, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. We're the ones that are actually qualified to talk about this because this is the world that we lived in. We grew up in this, you know, and when I talk about, you know, doing it, let's see. I just happened to find these. Let's see. State championship, national championship. Oh, look at that. Another national championship. US championship. This is the world championship. So if you can read that on the back, that's actually a separate martial art world kumdo championship, 2004 Busan, Korea. You know, I did this for most of my childhood and my adult life. Coming up on 38 years next week, I got taekwondo lessons for my 7th birthday. I'm about to turn older than that.
Oi, how's your man?
Welcome to the dojo. Leave your shoes outside the door.
I don't want to say 45. Oh, crap. I found some of my black belts, just a big pile of them here. You know, some of them even, you know, got the engraving and everything. And I did.
Yeah, actually, let's quickly explain that to the laymen and they're out there. Black belt is black belt, but there's also, like, in my style, we have writing on them. Now, it depends on what style you're doing and what country the style originates from, but you would have Korean on the side of your black belt with your name and degree, correct?
Yep, and actually, these are in, well, this one is in traditional kanji, which is universal to understood across a lot of Asia. So, and then I do have not one of the ones with me. I've got another one here with, yeah, that's another one in kanji. But there's different ranks that you can have. Some schools are really big on doing stripes. When I first started in martial arts 11 bajillion years ago, there was 5 belts. White, orange, green, brown, and black. And when I got the most recent of these black belts, the system was white, yellow, orange, green, purple, blue, brown, red, or red, brown, that goes back and forth depending on which school you're in, and then black. And those all have stripes, and you can be recommended, you can be decided. And it's... it's interesting. It's a very good business move because you keep people going longer. You show them incremental growth, but you don't actually have to do as much. And true. I've gotten away from that in my school. You know, the belts, as much as I am very proud of it, to have earned them, a lot of times I know a whole lot of guys that that got everything they paid for their black belt. You know, and that was about $850 is what they cost usually. And I know a whole lot of guys that never made black belt that could, you know, whip 7 shades of crap out of anybody you've ever met. And it's an interesting thing, but I did also find one other thing, and I found this in the closet. This is, I chose the name today. This is my team jacket Big Lee. And this is when I actually fought for the University of Iowa's National Collegiate Taekwondo team. That's where I actually got my first two national championship medals. Quite a bit of fun. I got to train with them, but a great time. And I will say, in watching Cobra Kai, you and I were talking about it as it premiered, so much of this is familiar. Like some of the more ridiculous things are obviously quite fictional, but whoever made this series grew up in the martial arts, because you don't get these details and these insights without knowing that weird, weird world.
100%. Robert Mark Kamen was the writer, who is a martial artist first and foremost, who was interested in creating this, you know, Rocky series, you could say. It's a Rocky-like series. It is a fight series. You're learning the martial arts through that Rocky model. It's a story about, you know, going up against bullies and vice versa, really overcoming your fears. Part of that is in the dojos. You have to face your fears in order to progress, and certainly your own insecurities when it comes to technique, kata, whatever it is, physicality, even your own mind, your own spirituality when it comes to wanting to persevere. This series encompasses all of that, which I think is why it's got such a good calling card to people like you and myself who have studied in a number of styles.
Yeah, and I will say that just the interesting characters that they brought in, as ridiculous as they all seem to be, are very, very real. And it's changed a little bit now, you know, with MMA, but growing up in the martial arts, these are the type of people you found there. You'd have a couple jocks, you'd have a couple Johnnies, but then you'd have a whole lot more Miguels and Robbies and Eli's. Mm-hmm. And it was a place where you could, you know, sort of find a niche that you couldn't get anywhere else. And it was, you know, for a lot of people, myself included, it's where you learn to actually have some sort of strength, some sort of power, some sort of control over things. You know, it was very much sold as like, oh, we're going to teach kids respect and discipline. And no, that's what you tell the parents. And I don't think that realistically I've seen a lot of kids learn that. What I have seen them learn is finding a place and realizing that they have strength and that they can affect things for good or for bad. And as much as I'd like to say that every sensei and sabam and sifu and laoshi and maestro I've ever trained with has been an upstanding gentleman with nothing but everyone's best interests at heart, these are businesses. And the ways with John Kreese and Terry Silver, I'm not going to name names, but I know those guys. And I've seen it more often than not. And the thing is, they don't turn everybody into these sociopaths, but they get one or two, and they get some notoriety, and everyone just sort of follows it. And because what we've done with, you know, this idea of, you know, these martial arts masters as being, you know, these wise and noble characters, we excuse it. And we say that, this is, you know, something that we don't understand. And, you know, just like in every aspect of life, we find a way to excuse the behavior of people that are on our side. So this one was no holds barred on this, these portrayals. And I like the ambiguity of every character. There's not a lot of even John Kreese has a lot of nuance. So,
Without a doubt, folks. Before we get head on into a deep discussion, it always happens with Lee and I. We definitely go from one end of the extreme to the other, and in between all of that, we'll definitely be covering some of our own experience in the martial arts, which is actually a lot closer than you'd think it'd be, even though we're continents apart. So we're going to look at that. But before we do, you can see it on the ticker just below here. Check out all the action more at LethalMullet.net. See, folks, I can't even say that there's that much on that ticker down there. But go and check out LethalMulletNetwork.podbean.com for all your action movies and more, all the trivia you're going to get. B-movies in particular are my speciality, and we cover that martial arts news, and of course, big movie news as well too. And you can catch us all at The Lethal Mullet on socials. We're now on TikTok as well, and goodness knows what else will open up, and we'll be on whatever network as well as, of course, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Lee, where can the folks here catch you?
They'll catch me waiting for them outside. Otherwise, you can catch me on Twitter and Instagram at The Way of the Way. Catch me under my name at Facebook, Lee Fillingsness. I'm always out doing stuff. You can check out my IMDb page under Lee Fillingsness. I'm a working actor, stuntman, fight choreographer, occasional writer and producer. Basically, whatever I can do to make movies, I've been doing it for the last little bit. So.
Awesome. And obviously, you bring a lot of your experience as a martial artist as well in there, which I think is fantastic because, you know, when people say martial arts film, and particularly if they come on my show and, you know, they're somebody that's fairly new to it, they'll say, oh, they're all made in Hong Kong, they're all done on wires, and they're all this, they're all that, which is very wrong. You know, there's many different ways of making things, when it comes to martial arts film, action film in general. And I think what you've done, you've come from, we should say to the folks, some very different martial arts. You've done, obviously, Taekwondo. You've done Kumdo, which is very like, for people out there, it's like Korean Kendo, pretty much. It's sword work. It's amazing stuff like that. Aikido and Bujinkan, which is samurai and ninja schools as well. So you've got a very broad spectrum there.
Yeah, I've also done traditional Scottish swordsmanship under Maestro Paul MacDonald. I've done some destrezza, which is Spanish rapier and dagger. I've studied recently with kind of the grand puba out of Sweden, this Myers staff and halberd techniques, as well as a little bit of dagger. But it's the one thing, fighting is the only thing that's really made sense to me. So as much as I'd like to say I understand Johnny Daniel, I really relate to Johnny in this show. There's a lot of that character that I see in myself. Maybe not the beating people up on the beach, but you know.
You know, I relate to some of the funniest stuff too that Johnny in particular did, like the going around on motorcycles. Like my mum's probably out there today checking out this show. She'd know that I've been on motorcycles and coming off them. Oh, God. Oh, hi, Mum. Now, you know. So, you know, that element of, you know, being an idiot on a motorbike, thanks to my mate Shane. Shane, if you're there today, you now know I'm calling you out. We're going on BMX tracks with motorbikes, you know, and he was influenced then hanging out with a different crowd. And we actually did use, 250cc and 100cc motorbikes going over these mounds. We were clearing three or four of them and then landing on our shoulders and then the bike after us. You know, so it's one thing. But for my background, similar to yours, you know, where you've had the Korean influence, I've had a lot of the Okinawan and Japanese influence. So my first watching of Karate Kid was what I said, hey, Mum, I want to do that. And I remember my dad, who knew nothing about martial arts. He was a football man, rugby league. That was his thing. And he said, son, you really want to do that, or would you rather play guitar? He said, we've got some money, but we've got enough money for one or the other. And I actually figured out I could actually learn guitar at school and for no money, so I could still do that. And so, of course, I started training in Shotokan karate, so the Funakoshi style. And, you know, that was great. It is what it is for kids. Very hard back then. There was none of the sort of cookie-cutter style that a lot of martial arts do these days. There's nothing flowery about it. We didn't do Zenkutsu Dachi, the long stance, properly, you got kicked out and thrown on your head, you know, or on your back and then put into a lock. So, you know, those senseis were hard.
We had, I will, again, not name names, but we had a guy that had a car antenna, and he would whip the back of your leg if you were not in your stance properly. And I'm thinking about it, and I've got some students, when they listen to this, they're gonna be like, wow, I guess Lee isn't as mean about stance as I thought. Like, that's the thing. Like, everyone always wants to learn, okay, how do I do a tornado kick, how do I do this, how do I do that? And I'm like, let me see your stance, and we're gonna work this stance, and we're gonna do that. And when I first did Taekwondo, it very liberally was ripping off Shotokan karate. The only difference was the kicks were higher. And that's kind of the truth of a lot of Korean martial arts. It's either made up or, you know, because Unfortunately, the wars in Korea had a huge damage. There is unfortunately not a real lineage for most martial arts. There are some sort of suspect relations. You know, Taekwondo, they say, is related to Taekyon. It was very much Shotokan karate until the 88 Olympics, which introduced Taekwondo as a kind of a, not a competition, but a exhibition sport. And then 92 became a medaled sport. And they had to kind of come up with their own thing because you can't say it's one thing and not the other. But I've actually got a – this is a gift. When I went to Korea, this was a gift. I was fortunate enough got to go to the Kukiwon, say hi and meet some people. But this is also from those 88 Olympics.
Oh, nice.
So – and – that is not a real medal, but that was one of those things when you compete at a certain level and you get to meet some people, they're like, yeah. But I still love Shotokan. Funakoshi was, you know, there's some great ideas there. And he kind of made the Japanese and Okinawan martial arts approachable.
Yes.
And really brought what we know of martial arts to the masses.
Oh, without a doubt. I think the thing that got me was I had basically a friend's father who was considered like an uncle to our family, who is definite Shotokan karate stylist. And he was, I think, a second or a third dan at the time. And he given it away. He trained at home but didn't train in the dojo anymore. And he always said, look, what you're doing is great, but he said you need to really try the harder style to really work your kata and pretty much just your core foundations of all your hand and foot skills and really getting the waist. It is all about the hips in those systems, the on, off, where you punch and coming off on the blocks and stuff like that. And so I did. I trained under his basically his co-sensei, and the two of them pretty much got me where I needed to be. But I think it was in my mid-teens where I'd seen a movie called Above the Law, and that movie changed my perspective on things. I've been fighting from a distance, and obviously Taekwondo and Karate, they do that because it's a striking art, and there's not a lot of takedown. There is a little bit, but it's a lot of very limited stuff. But when I saw Steven Seagal pulling off what he did and the amount of people attacking him and still being able to get around them and get away, and then one or two moves that Aikido did, I was in love, and I started Ki no Kenyo Kai style or Ki Society, which you did as well.
Yeah, well, a close cousin. I was Aikikai, and you know, this was 20 years ago now, or 22 years ago, studying actually again while I was at the University of Iowa. Shortly after I started was when Tohei Sensei passed away, and I always tell this story to my students. The furthest I've ever been thrown in my life, and I have done, I've wrestled, I've done jiu-jitsu, I've done some Vale Tudo, some Pancration, you name it, I've done it. The furthest I've ever been thrown in my life was by a little old Japanese lady, Tohei Sensei's widow, and she brought me up to the front of class like they always do to the biggest guy in the room, and I was... well known for not letting people have the locks. I had a few conversations with Sensei, and I'm like, if the technique is right, it'll work, but they're not moving me here. And boy, was her technique right. I am suddenly like, I did not believe I was in the place that I was. And I looked and there's this little old lady, but it was a humbling thing, but it also was something that allowed me to move beyond just being big. I fought heavyweight from the time I was 14, men's heavyweight. They actually moved me up from boys because I was 6'4", 240. Now I'm 6'7" and more than 240. We'll just say that. But when you have that type of size advantage, even fighting in heavyweight, you can be big enough to be good enough. That was one of those reminders, like that there's more to learn. And, you're talking about kata, and that's always a big discussion with people. And they're like, oh, no, you just got to do randori. You got to, do jiu-jitsu and do bag work and do Muay Thai. It's like, I already do that. But like the kata has made me so much better, so much more precise, and so much more fluid in my movement. So I'm glad you're another kata bro, because there's not enough of us.
Look, you know, to me, it doesn't matter what martial art I've done. You can't just be doing the sparring. You can't just be doing the basic technique, and you can't just be doing conditioning. It all encompasses the whole thing. And kata is a big part of it, especially when it comes to the bunkai, learning why things are the way they are. And, you know, particularly at my level, heading towards black belt now in this style, which I've only done now since, it was 2020, I'll get into it. So this is a new style for me. It is.
I think you just rose up on me.
You still there, bud? Yeah, let's have a look. There you are. There you are. I don't know what happened there.
Oh, we are? Okay.
Yeah. All right, I'll take it. Luckily, we're doing this with the audio one, but it's all good.
Yeah, you were talking about Bunkai with the style you've been doing since 2020, and then you kicked out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, so we're talking about the Bunkai. So you're learning that from each of these katas, and it being a Shotokan and Goju-Ryu hybrid, we're learning one Goju-Ryu kata onto then a kata of Shotokan. So we're going from like things like MP to Cypher, and then onto Basadai, and moving our way around those katas. But the interesting thing to me is being going through the history of these katas, why they were developed, why the Bunkai are the way they are, but also going back to the Okinawans, then taking it from White Crane Kung Fu and some older styles. Because really, at its heart, you know, they all have legacy, even the obviously the Korean arts as well.
Yeah, and I look at it, you know, my comparison with kata is when I go to the gym, you know, I am doing curls. I'm doing bench press. I'm doing all sorts of different exercises to work various parts. And when if all I do is just hit a bag and all I do is just train a move instead of train my body as a martial artist. And that's where, you know, with kata, like I'm training my body at the same time. And I'm doing a lot of the movements become sympathetic. So say I'm doing something that looks like a punch, I can actually turn that into my grabs and throws. And then suddenly I'm not learning 1,000 techniques. I'm learning how my body moves in a way to apply it 1,000 ways.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But have you ever read any of George Dillman's stuff or seen any of his videos?
I've seen some of his videos, and I do remember years ago seeing in the martial arts stores the books on the shelf alongside, you know, all the Stephen K. Hayes stuff as well. But Dillman's stuff's meant to be fantastic.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of his stuff. I've actually I need to get it transferred to DVD or something, but I've got his old it's a 20-volume VHS set on all of the classic Okinawan kata. And, you know, I mean, he's doing, you know, I mean, my favorite one was actually Pinyon, which I didn't really like originally, but the way he explains it and gets into like, okay, here's the actual grappling. So all the weird poses that you see martial artists doing, it's like, no, that's not how I want to fight you. This is actually, you know, how I'm manipulating you. And he gets into a lot of that. And then he also does with the Kobudo, which is the traditional Okinawan weapons, side, nunchuk, kama, staff. Basically most of the Ninja Turtle weapons, he actually shows how those techniques are also hidden in traditional kata, because karate means empty hand. This is how you train without the weapon, but you train, you know, the weapon doesn't change. You know, it's going to stay the same. You train your body. And by training your body, again, to do more than one thing at a time and to create a nimble mind, you're going to be a better fighter.
100%. One of the interesting things too about learning that is then going into, you know, different styles like Aikido, and even afterwards doing Bajinkan. Now, I was only in there for a short time, a little under a year, and I'd moved from one city to another. So there wasn't a Bajinkan school where I was going to. There was a ninjutsu school, but it was from a sensei who had left the style and basically was still doing Bajinkan, but just under his own name. He, I think, disenfranchised from Masaki Hatsumi.
Oh, so John Van Donk? Was that?
His name was Wayne something, Wayne Roy, I think it was.
Okay.
But it was pretty much same thing. It was still what the Bajin Can were teaching, and it was quite good. I really enjoyed it. The thing I enjoyed it was the different weapon systems that we were taught under him, you know. And I think the thing that he was trying to get across was how modern that style was. The idea was that, you know, as traditional as things are, Kazurigama, all these other shuriken, all that sort of stuff, he was also teaching, you know, modern stuff like firearm safety and stuff like that. Things that probably Australians don't get as much of as they're not prevalent in Australia, like in the US. But the knowledge of that stuff and how to use and how to keep safe was very, very much foremost in our dojos.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the, you know, I'm pretty sure you had the same experience I did. You walk into Bajin Can and they're, wait, why isn't everyone doing backflips? Why aren't they twirling their swords? Why aren't, it's like, you know, when you think about what a ninja is supposed to be, you know, they are secretive. They are, you know, kind of shadow warriors, for lack of a better term. The moves that you that work for that type of thing are not going to be the big blatant strikes that we're expecting to see. And so much of that strength is unexpected. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from angles that don't make sense to a normal person, but once you figure out their force diagram, it's in terms of physics, it's a brilliant martial art.
Yes, it really is. I mean, there's a lot of detractors now who, you know, will go on about the history, and probably rightly so, from the Ninja Scrolls being now translated into English. But there's still that history there. I mean, Bajin Can is more samurai than it is ninjutsu. A lot of people have got to remember that. It is about 10 different schools of feudal arts put together, and only four of them were actually a ninja, or known as shinobi no mono. So you're learning a samurai tradition.
Yeah, and, you know, there's an interesting culture, you know. I mean, even if you get into, like, the Yamabushi, you know, the mountain warrior monks, you know, even what is a samurai? You know, I mean, we've kind of got this, you know, Tokugawa shogunate idea of samurai that's basically like this crystallized idea of this warrior class, same way that we have a crystallized idea of a cowboy that's not entirely true, but not entirely false either. And getting into the reality of who they were, again, like I was saying about all the martial arts instructors I know, they're not always the best and kindest and most upstanding people.
That's right.
They're people to start. Like, they're, and I don't know how many people you've met, but I've met a whole bunch of them that weren't all that great.
100%. There's politics in any business, whether it be the dojo, work, vice versa, you know, and they're all different people. And part of that is that, you know, you got some people that are, you know, going to be probably more humble and more, you know, downright just ready for the development of everybody in kind and no greed, all that sort of stuff. But there's a whole bunch out there that are out for, I hate to say it, not even for the McDojo side of it, but that are out for the bottom dollar. And those that are out there will push anyone aside, and you're not going to get your training from those people, because that's not about the training for you. It's about them actually surviving in the business and excelling.
Yeah, I've called it the green belt curse for a long time. You're going to make a whole lot more money if you've got a room full of green belts than if you have a room full of black belts, because the green belts have been there for probably about 2 years. And if they keep going, hey, that's great. But I want a whole crowd of white belts that keep coming in every, you know, few months. You know, New Year's resolution is always a good time. It's like, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do something. Martial arts sounds fun. And they'll come in and you'll have a room full of 30 students at a time, each of them paying $75 a month. You do two classes like that a night. You know, you're making some serious coin. From a business standpoint, it, you know, training them to be black belts doesn't really matter. Train them enough that they feel good. You know, don't criticize them enough so that they doubt their technique. And that's where you get into the McDojos, and that's where you get into a lot of, you know, the arts that I love, you know, karate and taekwondo, getting such a bad rap is because we did it to ourselves. We started treating it like a commodity instead of the art that it's supposed to be. And I've been a bouncer. I have been dumb enough to be in fights in the real world, and I have used taekwondo. I have used aikido. I've also used jiu-jitsu. I've used Muay Thai. There's nothing quite like an elbow upside the temple to let somebody know how much you care about them. But these arts have survived for, you know, decades and centuries because at one point they worked.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunately the people that took the art turned it into a business that made our arts of karate and taekwondo kind of into jokes.
Yeah. They have. I mean, what's interesting is that, like, you know, the advent of UFC, everyone's an expert, pretty much. That's the mentality that, you know, whether it's on YouTube or on any of these different places where people will obviously vent their own frustration and opinion that traditional styles don't work. Aikido's a joke. Ninjutsu, what's that? That's crazy. And everything has to be, like, Brazilian jiu-jitsu has pretty much ruled the roost when it comes to stuff.
Yeah, well, and if you look at, you know, the first one, that was kind of a joke. Royce Gracie didn't need to fight by the same rules as everyone else did. Nobody else was allowed to have a gi, and there he is using the gi as a weapon against people. Yeah. The guy that took second was out of shape in his 40s, and he fought well. Like, that's a guy that, you know, kind of the scion of a martial arts family. And the rest of the world hadn't heard of the Gracies yet, but if you read Black Belt Magazine, you saw all their articles, you saw all the tapes, everyone in our world knew who they were. And then you go forward to UFC number 4, what I consider the best fight anybody really put up against Gracie as a striker was against this guy, Keith Hackney. He was out of New England. I want to say he weighed...
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
There you are.
Might be getting a bit of interference. Is it just, it's not the program, it'd be the internet. There's a cyclone not far off the coast of Queensland here, so that may be cutting us out now and again. Yeah, it's pretty bad. But for here, we just get a cut in transmission now and again, which could be easy enough to patch in later, so it's all sweet.
Fair enough. But, yeah, just to the point, though, like, you've got the Gracies, these professionals, like, best at what they do, inviting just random guys from around the country, some of them pretty good, but not enough, you know. I mean, number two, they had, you know, Ron Van Cleef, who was in his 50s, you know, like, and Gracie just kind of cuddled him into submission, you know, which was a gentleman thing to do, but, like, he wasn't, you know, prepared for that kind of fight. You know, he couldn't be. Like, I'm in my 40s. I'm still working as a stuntman. I wouldn't jump in the ring right now. I mean... Okay, maybe I would, but I'm stupid. I definitely wouldn't do, you know, like a world championship sort of thing.
Yeah.
But and also anyone looking at UFC saying, oh, yeah, that's proof. They're fighting on mats. And if you've ever done a striking style, those mats turn your toes. And I don't care if it's taekwondo or boxing. You learn to turn on the balls of your feet. When you're on those mats, you can't do that. And that's why everyone's striking like they're in fifth grade when they're trying to hit in UFC. Yeah. It's because they can't deliver the same type of force that we've all learned how to do.
Can't generate through your feet, 100%.
Yeah.
Basic boxing and karate and taekwondo principle. And that's one of the things, too, is in Hoist went in and pretty much first technique he would do on them was the two-legged takedown, a very, very simple thing that's taught in all grappling schools, even wrestling. You know, and then from there would always go for the forward or rear naked choke. Yep. He would always put in submission that way. Look, and even Bill Superfoot Wallace, one of the greatest kickers out there, who was calling, I think, a lot of those fights, was given a script by the Gracies. And again, it was a marketing thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he's actually come out. He was on Jesse Ankamp's show, The Karate Guy. By the way, I love that dude. Just talking about what BS that whole thing was. And he's called him out for it. There's a reason he didn't go back. But yeah, like they had him and Kathy Long, who was, you know, just a fantastic kickboxer. And they got, you know, two luminaries as kickboxers calling the fight, but they didn't bring in an actual good kickboxer. Now, Pat Smith, you know, good fighter, but not at a level of the Gracies.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a completely different kind of fish when it comes to what there really is. Now, folks, before we get into the Karate Kid, I want to bring up a show that Lee and I did, probably one of our first shows, actually, which was Best of the Best, looking at the 1989, was it 89 that came out? I'm pretty sure it was 88 or 89. I can't remember now. But such a damn good film. And it's something that Eric Roberts was on fire. He'd done not only Best of the Best 1 and 2, but he also did By the Sword just about the, around the same time. Three of my favorite fight or, you know, training films. I tell you, I'd like to ask you now, would you like to be on a show with us in a couple of weeks doing By the Sword? I'd love to have you on for that.
You know, I'll do that, but I'm going to say there's a couple of my old buddies that should be on that too. I just spent a couple, spent a week with some friends of mine who own some fencing schools out in Seattle. One of them is one of the biggest schools I've ever heard of. He has 180 fencing students.
My God.
Yeah. I know people with that have franchise schools that have that, but he's talking they're real students, not just I'm just going to sign up. You don't just jump into a fencing class like you do in taekwondo class. All you need is a $10 uniform that they usually give you for free for taekwondo. Yeah. But he's legit. And we were talking about this movie, you know, good and bad. He has a buddy that was in it. And I'll have to confirm, but he decided not to be on the dance team side. You know, when they have
their little dancing moves. Yeah,
and I guess he's regretted it because that's a little bit more iconic. But And I think that was the last movie I saw Mia Sara in, who also played Sloane Peterson in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
And she was also her new role as wife of Brian Henson. A lot of people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
Fantastic.
She was married to Jean-Claude in Time Cop.
Oh, yeah, she was too. Great movie. Now, I've got to say a big shout-out to one of our friends, former member and certainly at the start of Phantom Podcast Network, Norman C. Lau. If you're out there today, Norman, what a big shout-out to you. You've jumped into getting back into training hard, like you've done HEMA before, and now getting into the Filipino systems, these traditional systems of the knife, the stick, and just Cully and Eskrima. Mate, it's great to see, and, you know, I've dabbled in that stuff. I've never fully trained in it, but the speed and the cardio involved in it really is an amazing thing, and it's great for Filipino heritage. Those martial arts are just amazing.
Yeah, and Norm has had this amazing path in the martial arts. He's been really lucky in the people that he's been able to train with. I mean, you know, obviously through he was my predecessor on Blood of Kings. So he actually got to train with Anthony DeLongis, who's, you know, everything. Taught Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer how to use a bullwhip. Was in the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe live action movie. You know, just crazy amounts of stuff. You know, two episodes of Highlander, and but also training with R.J. McGeehan, who is, you know, one of the notable names in our world. You know, and guy's been on several television shows, all that. But I just got to say, Norm, put the shirt back on. You're making us all look bad. You're way too cut for your age. Start looking like an old dude.
Now, folks, I'm just going to put this up because we've just talked about the very actor, and he gets a pretty big part at the start of the movie, which, you know, again, this was meant to be called The Silent Flute originally, and it's a story that was pretty much Bruce Lee's and Jimmy Coburn's, if I remember correctly. But the man that put this together was also Paul Maslansky, the producer of a movie I just talked about, which is, of course, Police Academy as well. So, you know, there's a lot of differences in this one. David Carradine plays multiple roles in it. But, of course, the one person in this, Anthony DeLonghi's, one of his earliest roles, and he's also in Jaguar Lives with Joe Louis, where he plays pretty much the bad guy. Actually, he gets the better role because in that one he's doing a lot of classical karate. The 70s heavy karate kung fu influence was in that one in a James Bond manner. And it's the second movie he did with Christopher Lee.
I will say, though, my favorite thing he ever did was in the opening of Fearless. Has a fight against Jet Li, and he's using he's supposed to be a Spanish swordmaster, but he's using a model 1912 U.S. cavalry sword as designed by George Patton. And it is one of the most breathtaking and electrifying fights I've seen on film. And he gives Jet Li a really good fight. You know he's got to lose because he's fighting Jet Li, but it's not an easy win for Jet on this one. And I actually got to talk to Anthony about this a few months ago, almost a year ago now, when we interviewed him on Blood of Kings for actually a big Highlander virtual convention. But yeah, that's... You know what? I'm going to watch that later on today. That's a good fight.
Nice.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. The Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. The Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.